Good morning. This is the 9 o'clock talk. R squared, the exponential growth of rootkit techniques by Jimmy Butler, Nick Petroni, and William Arbaugh.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for waking up early. The 9 a.m. slot is always the killer slot. The fact that Jamie made it here is a testament to how many people are actually here, I guess. So Jamie getting up by 9 a.m. is something important in its own right. This talk is not going to be earth-shattering in that we're not going to teach you any new techniques. What we want to do is just kind of cover the history of rootkits a little bit and lay a foundation so that you have it for the rest of the day's talks. So if you're here expecting some earth-shattering announcement or something like that, you're not going to hear it, and unfortunately we're going to disappoint you. Hopefully what we will do, however, is show you kind of the trends that we're seeing in the rootkit space and how the field is kind of evolving, if you will. So kind of the obligatory agenda outline slide. Basically, we want to talk about some definitions. If you look in this area, the definitions kind of vary based upon who's making it. We want to talk about some emerging trends. We'll cover the history of rootkits. Rootkits are actually rather old in terms of their heritage, although they're just now becoming into prominence. Jamie's going to talk about some of the different rootkit techniques that are out there, just in an overview sense. We'll talk about detection and remediation. Again, kind of at a high level space, some of the problems that you have with both, and then we'll finish it up and of course, take questions. The other thing, at least when I'm speaking, if you have a question, I'm a university professor by trade, which means I don't really work, but throw a question out. If you have a question, you don't have to hold it to the end. I can take it when you have it so you don't forget. If we get too much up off a tangent, though, I'll kind of probably pull it off. So let's talk about what a rootkit actually is. We believe that a rootkit is something that hides some object within the operating system from higher-level applications and from the operating system itself. Rootkits also can provide persistence. Kind of the standard definition has been hiding, but there's also been a recent trend in providing persistence to spyware and things like that so that the anti-spyware programs can't delete the spyware. The anti-spyware runs, it thinks it's deleted the spyware, but yet it's still there because of modifications that have been made in the operating system itself. The other interesting thing about rootkit technology is, and this is pretty much true for all security technology, and that is it's inherently dual use. And what I mean by that is it can be used for good or it can be used for evil. And really what determines whether or not it's good or evil is the intent of the authors or the writers of that software and how it's used. You can potentially have good software, the intentions of the author were good, but it's doing some things that are not in concert with the way the user wants to use that system. And so you kind of break it down into you have good programs that are using some of these techniques, you have some potentially unwanted programs that are using these techniques, and of course you have the flat-out malicious programs that want to do great damage and harm to you. The intent is really predicated upon two different questions. And the first is that the owner of that system really needs to have informed consent as to, what that program is going to be doing. Yeah. I'm sorry? Who am I? Oh, I'm sorry. The guy introduced us here. I'm Bill Arbaugh. I'm from the University of Maryland on sabbatical working with Komaku. So that's who I am. I can show you my passport afterwards if you need retinal scans available. Sorry, I will not give blood, however. So you need to have informed consent of the user of the system. Now, this is kind of where we get a little bit tricky because the user of the system may or may not be the owner of the system. right? And you get into some, you know, I'm not going to get into the legal tar pit here, but there are a lot of little nuances there that you have to be very careful about. And then finally, the approval of the owner of the system. So, you know, if you're doing something, and, you know, the Sony rootkit is the, you know, one that we're all probably most familiar with, you know, there they had, you know, depending on your definition, good intentions. But what they didn't do is inform the users and the owners of those systems what they were doing and give them a chance not to install that software. And so this is where you get into the kind of the gray areas of this space. So that kind of finishes it up for, or you know, kind of moving on with definitions. The other thing that we see happening right now, and this is happening on a scale much faster than I think anyone ever anticipated, and that is you have spyware, which typically has been userland based. You have rootkits, which, you know, really cross the border between userland and kernel land, but, you know, more recently have been more and more kernel land. You basically see the combination of these two techniques, if you will, joining arms so that you have a userland component being protected or hidden by a kernel land component. There really isn't a good definition for this. We kind of came up with the rather unusual rootware definition just because we're not very clever in taking two compound words and splitting them and putting them together is the way to go. But I think that's the, you know, when you have a hybrid element like this, I think you really need a new definition for it. The spyware stuff traditionally has been all userland. Rootkits, in their infancy, started out in userland but quickly moved down into kernelland. And now you've got the two kind of combining into something that's very, very difficult to detect and incredibly, even more difficult to eliminate. So that's kind of it for our definitions. I said earlier that rootkits have been around for quite some time. For those of you, I've been working in the security area for over 20 years, and so I actually remember the cuckoo's egg. Some people probably weren't born when the cuckoo's egg occurred, and some of you probably don't even know what I'm talking about. This was one of the probably the first famous, in terms of popular press attention, computer intrusions. When the internet was something that, you know, only us academics and other people used. But basically what happened is you had somebody break into the computers at Lawrence Berkeley Labs, and they modified the, I think they were actually applications and not the kernel there, but they modified the usual administrator tools to hide themselves. And Cliff Stoll basically recognized a less than $1 discrepancy in the audit logs, in the billing logs, and, you know, took it upon his mission to trace down these 75 cents, you know, to save his employer that egregious damage. And it turned out to be, you know, a relatively sophisticated group operating out of, I think it was Germany, that had penetrated the system, and you know, a number of others as well. So this is kind of the real first popular press exposure to rootkits, although they weren't really called rootkits at that time. You've got a FRAC article that was written in the 1980s as well about hiding, you know, a TTY so you could log in and hide your presence that way. So, you know, rootkits, you know, probably, you know, 20 years or more. If you actually wanted to do a very sophisticated search, we'd probably find the guys at Bell Labs and stuff were talking about this stuff long before anybody else was. Again, kind of continuing, the rootkits really started in the Unix community. This is because these were the computers that were connected to the internet for the most part back then. And they started out in userland, just hiding, you know, with the system administrator tools. Eventually, they did move down into the kernel. You started to see device drivers and things like that appear. I mean, it's kind of the standard evolution of malware, if you will, and that is you kind of start at the level you understand, and as people start to understand more and more of the internals, you go lower and lower. You know, we had the boot root demonstration, I think, last year, as far as a rootkit, where you actually put that in the BIOS. How low can you go is a question I'm not sure I really want answered. They kind of moved into the Windows community in 1999 with Greg talking about rootkits in that space. And, you know, around that time, people started to understand the kernel internals of Windows a little bit more. You had a number of books published about them. You had more a much larger developer base. And so the expertise started to grow of how to make changes to the operating system. And it only follows then that rootkits are going to come out of that. So we're basically basing a lot of our research in this talk on work of others. McAfee released a report on rootkits recently, you know, that talked about a 400% growth in the number of rootkits that they saw. And they expect that to actually get worse. And so, you know, this problem is not going away, unfortunately. And, you know, it'd be nice if we could, you know, release a new operating system with all kinds of great new features in it and magically rootkits will disappear. But we all know that's not going to happen. The threat will evolve and find ways around those defenses, and rootkits will still be with us. So just to kind of give you an idea of what is being seen in the wild, you have a lot of them being combined with keyloggers right now. I mean, kind of the standard, if you think about what the standard classes of malice are, keyloggers, backdoors, worms, we're seeing all of these classes being combined with rootkits to give them more stealth and in some cases persistent. So, you know, the keyloggers are probably the bigger problem right now for a number of reasons. And so the mini keylogger, the powered keylogger, these are both things that are hiding their process, hiding their hooks through the use of a driver. And in the powered keylogger, it's even hiding its registry entries and its files as well. Kind of even more detailed breakdown. And if you look, most of these guys are using kind of the initial first wave of rootkit techniques, and that is basically function call hooking. You've got some at the bottom down there now that are actually using DCOM, and the top five here all are loading a driver. The bottom two are somewhat unique in that they're actually loading themselves by writing directly to physical memory. So they're not going through the Windows driver API. And so that's kind of, and they're also using DCOM, which is again, you know, both of these are kind of step ups from, you know, your standard basic rootkit techniques, if you will. And the other, in my opinion, issue that makes these somewhat nasty is that they're worms. That means that, you know, they get into your system, they're going to be looking for other targets, and, you know, before you know it, you could potentially lose your entire network. And with, you know, rootkit recovery technology at the state of what it is, you're basically going to be spending a few late nights and weekends re-imaging all your systems under the assumption that you have a good image to use. So at this point, because I'm a manager and don't know anything about technology, I'll turn this over to Jamie, who will kind of talk about the nitty-gritty details of things.
I was going to try to say I was Nick Petroni. My name is Jamie Butler. I'm a CTO with Bill's company and claim to fame. I wrote a little book about rootkits last year with Greg Hoagland. We'll just quickly give an overview of some of the techniques that rootkits have used, both historically and more recently, and kind of give you a little insight into what makes them so hard to detect. Like Bill said, the cuckoo's egg, things like that, they replace binaries on the file system, so that used to be a methodology. Then Greg's rootkit came along in around 99, I believe it was, and he was started hooking memory at the time. He said that Tripwire and other forensic programs weren't enough because you could just go to memory and start modifying things there, accomplish the same goals as replacing things on disk, and no one was looking in memory. Recently, the operating systems provided you with callbacks. There's specialized registers now There's people using layered device drivers. We'll get into examples of all these and what they mean. Another way to hide your presence is to manipulate kernel data yourself. A couple years ago, I pioneered a rootkit called FU, and it used a term called DCOM, Direct Kernel Object Manipulation. With that, if you understand the structures within memory, you can just start changing them at will, and you'll completely disappear from all the higher-level APIs that the operating system would expose to a developer in order to find files or find processes and so forth. I believe there's going to be some talks about virtualization and some rootkits moving into the virtualized world where they're in the hypervisor and therefore they can hide from the untrusted domains and subvert those. So a quick slide on hooks. There's several different types of hooks. An inline hook, also called a detour patch, it's when you actually modify the binary function in memory. Normally this is to implement a jump or a call to your rootkit code. This is actually extremely similar to Microsoft's hot patching. They provide a nice little skeleton for you to be able to put an inline patch directly into their code. Makes it fun. There's also system call hooks. That's what historically memory-altering rootkits did, like Hoagland's NT rootkit. It would replace calls in the system call table with pointers to the rootkit code itself, and therefore you gain execution, can manipulate the data. Then there's import address hooking. That is when you're writing a Windows program, you share certain DLLs because you don't want to write all the functionality yourself. You rely upon Microsoft and others. And at load time, the import address table patches up the function addresses that you need to use with where they're loaded in memory. So that's all done at load time. So you can alter that in memory and quickly gain execution flow control. IDT hooks, interrupt descriptor table hooks. These are used in rootkits like ShadowWalker and others. These are usually a little bit more advanced type rootkits. They're within the kernel and they're trying to gain execution when an interrupt fires. ShadowWalker used this technique in order to take over your page fault handler and then disguise the contents of memory. So a read to that region of memory would not display the rootkit code itself. ERP table hooks are ERPs or IO request packets, and what they're used for is to, when a system call is made to like a write file or write to a socket and so forth, it flows through the system call table, but eventually it hits the driver that exposes that functionality. Every driver has an ERP table of about 32 functions that says upon certain requests, go to this address and execute. Therefore, if you can hook the file system driver, its ERP table in order to gain execution and manipulate file writes and so forth or file queries. Callbacks are interesting because Microsoft has provided nice ways for developers to get called back upon certain system events on the computer. So you can say, hey, when a file access is made, I want to be called because I'm writing my own security software that's going to do some file filtering or maybe some inline encryption and so forth. Others are the Windows messaging system is all based upon events. You can register to receive callbacks or notifications when a key is pressed or the mouse is moved and so forth. So this is how almost all commercial keyloggers work. They register a callback for the keystroke monitoring. There's object manager function callbacks. We won't go into too much detail about those. They're pretty low level, and they're not actually exposed through a nice API to you. in this protocol are more or less function callbacks where you can say, hey, I have my own protocol that's going to talk on the network, and therefore when a receive happens, I need to get called back when that transpires. And then I'm going to do something with the packet and pass it on, perhaps. So just the nature of the documentation of how these are implemented and the fact that they're standard makes detection very difficult, because now you have to determine, is it a legitimate piece of software that's registered this callback, or is it malicious? Special registers, you can set up debug registers so that when memory is accessed or a certain instruction is executed at an address, you'll break into your debugger. The rootkit can set up its own debugger and get called that way. There's also the model-specific registers in the more recent architectures from AMD and Intel. These are equivalent to an interrupt descriptor table hook in many ways. You can register that, or you can overwrite the MSR register for sysenter, for example. In that register is just stored the address of the function that will handle the sysenter call. You can overwrite that with your own address in order to gain execution. That address will get called every time there's a system call from user mode to kernel, because it needs to alert the kernel, hey, I got some work for you to do, and I'm transitioning from user mode to kernel mode, and so you get called a lot there. There was actually a fairly recent example of this. I think the Rastoka rootkit used this mechanism in order to gain execution. Layered device drivers. These are also documented, a way to gain execution control. Every single device on the system can be layered. So you can layer on top of the file system. You can layer on top of the keyboard driver. You can layer on top of the network device itself. And you'll receive these ERPs that we spoke of earlier before the actual device that should handle it. So it's a it's a nice way to gain execution control, and you can use this in order to hide yourself within the system. There's been a lot of... This is one way to implement keystroke monitoring as well, although not many people do it. And then there's direct kernel object manipulation, which I said a few years ago, like 2003, 2004, maybe a bit earlier than that. Anyway, I started that with the FU rootkit, and then recently it's progressed to the FU2 rootkit, which took another... Not only did it unlink the linked list of processes, which is a data structure within the kernel, but it also took the additional measure of unlinking the handle tables and going after the handles themselves in memory, because there was a security product on the market that was using the handle table in order to find the hidden processes. So we continue to see evolution in the cat and mouse game. As soon as someone comes out with a better mouse trap, you know, there's someone that's figured out a way to break it. Although each attack gets more advanced, harder to detect, and makes your system less stable.
All right, so that's kind of the background on, you know, what the state of the art, if you will, in rootkit techniques. Now, kind of turn the tables here now, and let's look at, you know, what are the ways that people are commonly using to detect these rootkits, and then talk kind of briefly about the remediation. One of the issues with rootkit detection is that it's pretty much like asking a crazy person if they're crazy. You really can't trust the answer. And so you need to find some way to correlate external or additional information and see if the answers that crazy person is giving you are actually accurate. And so several of these techniques actually do that. The heuristic and behavioral detection, we'll talk about that kind of sets up a notion of what is normal for the system to be operating, and then looks for deviations from that. Integrity detection is pretty well known in the file system space. It's recently been moved into the memory space. Signature-based detection we're all familiar with. You know, that was kind of the core AV technology from years ago. And then the diff-based or cross-view detection, this is kind of what I just talked about, where you ask the crazy person a question, but then you ask another question in a different way, or you know, get the answer from some external information and then compare them to make sure if they see make sense. So kind of different examples on these, and we'll talk about each of these things in a little bit more detail. So as far as integrity checkers, there's actually, and so Jamie mentioned, he joked that he was going to introduce himself as Nick Petroni. Nick can't be here because concurrently with Black Hat is the USENIX security conference up in Vancouver. And Nick and I and Aaron Walters and Tim Frazier have a paper in that talking about semantic integrity, which I'll talk about in a second. And so Nick had to leave last night in order to get to Vancouver to present our paper there. But bitwise integrity is, you know, what we're all probably familiar with, MD5, SHA-1, SHA-256 hashes. They basically look at the scalar representation of the bits, whether they be on the file or whether they be in memory. You take a checkpoint or a baseline, a snapshot as we call it, and you know, you compare it at some point later in time, and the robustness of the cryptographic hashes should indicate if there's any tampering with those bits. Of course, if you're a cryptographer, it's early, I can't even talk yet, you'll know that you know, there are some collision problems with MD5, hints of same issues with SHA-1, and so you know, SHA-256 is kind of what people are looking at these days, but that's incredibly slow. Another approach, and this is the subject of our paper up at USENIX Tech Conference, or Security Conference, is what we call semantic integrity. And with this, rather than looking at the actual scalar values of the bits, what we're actually looking at are first-order predicate logic statements about the state of the system. And much like with a bitwise integrity system, you want that to remain invariant. You don't want it to change as the system's operating. The semantic predicates need to be the same thing. They need to be invariant throughout the correct operation of the system. And I'll talk about these in a little bit more. There are two things that we're aware of that are doing bitwise integrity. Our product, Joanna's SVV, which she's released, it's fairly well known. It's been used by a lot of people in the file system, like I said before. The really interesting thing about it is it's incredibly powerful, but it's also very, very difficult to do on a wide scale. And you know, when you start to take into account all the various changes that you may have in a system, you know, across all the systems that are being used, coming up with a set of hashes for that is actually fairly difficult. The other limitation of this approach is that it's really limited to immutable data. The data and the text have to be invariant throughout the operation of the system. And you have a number of products out there that are using rootkit techniques, believe it or not, hooking the various tables. Some of them are actually even patching the NTOS kernel as it runs. And you know, this kind of goes into the beginning of our talk with is how is it that you determine, you know, is that a rootkit that's doing those changes, or is it, you know, a program that you actually want to be running on your system? And that's a very difficult problem. With semantic integrity, we try to take it up a little bit of a level and try and eliminate a lot of these problems by, instead of just looking at the scalar representation, you know, look at a logic expression and make sure that that logic expression remains invariant throughout the operating system. So a good example of what we use with semantic integrity is something that will detect, you know, foo and foo2 type attacks where you try to hide a process. The usual technique for that is that you take the process off the process list, but you leave it on the thread list. And so you have kind of an inconsistency in the state of the operating system. And so a semantic predicate for that would be basically, you know, there shouldn't exist a thread without a corresponding process entry. And that's something that's very easy to check, and, you know, it should be, you should never see that situation in a running system. If you do, either somebody's trying to hide a process or something, you know, grievous has happened to the memory of that system. And so that's kind of the standard example of what we think of with semantic integrity. And you can kind of take that a lot further out and come up with, a whole set of these things. The problem is how do you come up with them? And that's the subject of the talk at Usenix Security, at least partially anyway. So the other approach that we're all pretty much familiar with, you know, is your standard signature-based detection techniques. This searches the file system or memory for a database of signatures. And, you know, your detection capability is only as good as your signature database, and, you know, obviously that is a lifetime associated with that. So if you're not getting constantly updated with your signatures, then you're going to be exposing yourself to a window of vulnerability, if you will, because it's basically a priori, or I mean, post priori detection of problems. And so it's good. It's been very effective for a lot of years. It still is very effective. But again, it opens you up to the 0 days. Behavioral detection is something that in the last few years has kind of moved into the Windows space. It's actually been talked about for quite some time in the academic literature. Calvin Coe of UC Davis, Stephanie Forrest of University of New Mexico have been looking at behavioral detection for some time. You know, their standard technique was basically to watch system calls and create a state machine of these system calls and then look for any deviation out of that state machine. Really what it comes down to is they were trying to come up with an approximation for the normal operation of that system. And if you have a very, very constrained system, that's something that's doable and, you know, you won't get many false positives, because the operations on that system are very constrained. But if you take a general purpose system, like what we're used to using on our laptops or at our desktop, you just load up Internet Explorer and you know, you're gonna see a litany of activity that is beyond normal by these state machines. And they basically are littered with false positives as a result of that. And from an academic or theoretical standpoint, nobody's really come up with a very effective behavioral type system. Unless you have a very constrained system that's operating under some constraints. So the other approach is the cross-view detection technique, which we talked about earlier. Rootkit Revealer, I think, does a little bit of this, as do some other, I think RAID does this. A number of other things out there take this kind of approach where you ask one question, you ask the same question basically in two different ways, and now you want to compare the results. If anybody's actually familiar with producing surveys, this is why when you're actually filling out a survey that's been well prepared, you'll think like you've answered the same question three or four different times. And if, essentially you have. They've just phrased it in different ways to try and make sure that you're just not randomly checking blocks. And this is essentially the way that cross-view detection works. Ghostbuster Strider did this from a clean boot. The idea was that you would take a picture or a snapshot of the system, you'd shut down, you'd boot from a CD-ROM, and you know you would now compare the questions that you asked from the running system to a clean system that was booted from the CD-ROM and compare the differences. Very effective in terms of catching things. Unfortunately, you have to shut your system down in order to do that, and that's not something that is readily available to everybody. So, all right. So, what makes detection so hard? And again, this kind of goes back to asking the crazy person if they're crazy or not. You really, when you have a rootkit on the system, can't trust any answer that system's going to be giving you. And so you have to come up with a way to try and eliminate, you know, make yourself independent of that running system as much as possible so that you make sure that you get basically sound answers. And this is a problem for, you know, whether you're in the kernel itself running as a driver or whether you're running as an application. You know, more so if you're running as an application with Windows because of all the layers you've got. But you really can't trust the answers. And so what do you do? And the other problem is as I've talked about, you know, security technology is dual use. So there's a rootkit from China out there that provides a backdoor called UAY. This particular rootkit basically uses the same techniques that ZoneAlarm uses. And so how is it that you differentiate between UAY and ZoneAlarm? And there are ways, but it's not the most straightforward thing in the world. All right, so, you know, it's really hard to tell if you have a rootkit on your system. What happens if you actually can determine that you have a rootkit on your system? What is it that you do? Well, this is where you get into an even bigger can of worms, if you will, and that is a lot of these rootkits make some very detailed changes to the running operating system. And as Jamie mentioned, some of them actually make the operating system unstable. And so how is it now that you can take basically this unstable system and try and, you know, bring it back into stability? I mentioned in the last slide that you want to have independence and basically isolation as much as possible from the running system to detect the rootkit. Now, in order to make any changes to the running system, you need to have very, very close coordination with that system. You basically need to be able to put a memory lock on the space that you're going to be changing so that the system doesn't crash, you know, because you have a race condition here. But the problem is we have a chicken and the egg. That close cooperation with the operating system is at odds of us being isolated and independent with that operating system. And so there's kind of a balancing act that you have to make here when you want to try and do remediation, if you can. There are going to be some changes that these rootkits make to the running system that pretty much make it impossible to recover from. The other very, very important aspect here is that in order to repair the damage, if you will, that a rootkit has done to your system, you basically need to be able to write into the kernel space of the running system. If you're an application or even a driver, you now basically become the ultimate rootkit vector if you can be subverted because you're going to have unlimited write access to that system. So, you know, again, you know, do you really want to, you know, where's the balance here between opening up a brand new hole, you know, protecting yourself or recovering, if you will. It's not impossible, but it's a very delicate balancing act that you've got to deal with. So, anyway, finishing up, you know, rootware, basically as we define, and we're seeing more and more of these hybrid instances of malware appearing out there on the scene. The threat is evolving, obviously. Obviously, the detection techniques have to evolve as well. And the problem with rootkits is because they are so low level, we have a lot of problems in detecting them because of intent issues. You know, how is it that, I mean, basically you're talking about making the rootkit detection system self-aware in a way, because how is it that that can detect intent? It really can't. You have dual use technology that you basically have to be able to deal with. Is it, you know, a valid program that's modifying NTOS kernel, or is it a malicious or a PUP? And then finally, the remediation is incredibly difficult, and, you know, in some cases it's going to be impossible. You know, if a rootkit blue screens the machine, obviously you're not going to be able to recover from that. And a lot of these rootkits do put the system into a really bizarre state, such that any changes are going to basically cause an instant blue screen. So, Anyway, that's basically what we have. If you have any questions, other than asking who I was, you know, there wasn't any. You already asked your question for the day, sir, so let me know. I'll get you in a second. Yeah, go ahead. Right. I mean, that's certainly a possibility, right? I mean, it's dual-use technology.
So, yeah,
so the question was, there's a trend with hypervisor rootkits. Is there anything that's being done with respect to hypervisor detection methods? And you know, basically, it's dual-use technology. So, you know, is it possible? Probably. Yeah, in the back. Is what making a comeback? I don't know what that is.
Which one?
ZK. Do you know what that is? I'm sorry, I don't know. Yes?
Something like RPE takes a lot of files off of an actual Windows system. Are you aware of any rootkits that booted with RPE the boot of RPE, or is that a relatively safe method to try to
I'm not aware of it. So the question is, BART-PE, are there any rootkit attacks against BART-PE? I'm not aware of any. Jamie's not. I mean, just because we're not aware of something doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. And, you know, basically everything can be attacked. It's just a matter of whether somebody wants to go to the trouble of doing it. So, you know, you got to trust your you know, there's an old Russian saying, trust but verify. You know, Ronald Reagan used it as well. But, you know, basically, you got to trust your tools, but you need to verify them. So, yes? I think they put them on the Black Hat website. We'll certainly make it available to them for that, and we'll probably put it on the company website as well. Mm-hmm. Not seeing any other questions. Thanks everybody for getting up so early. Have a good day.